This podcast is for educational purposes only. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect the official policy or position of the Ted Stevens Center, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
Evan Bloom, welcome to the program. I would love to pull some threads on your Pacific connections. We have a program here called Arctic Connections, but you have over 30 years of diplomatic experience, some of which involves elements of the Pacific theater. So perhaps before I ask you to pull some threads on your professional connections in the Pacific realm, maybe just introduce yourself and talk about your career so people are aware of how you're able to connect the polar regions, and in this context, the Arctic, to the Indo-Pacific region.
Sure, Matt. Happy to do so, and thanks for having me on your program. So I had about a 30-year career at the U.S. Department of State. Before that, I was trained as a lawyer and lived and worked in Tokyo, Japan, for a corporate law firm there. And then after a stint in Washington, D.C. in a big corporate firm there, I joined the State Department in the Office of the Legal Advisor, and held any number of positions, as people who come to the State Department often do. But I was ultimately, and for a large portion of my career, head of the office that that handled oceans policy and Arctic policy and those sort of issues. I also had the privilege of being involved in setting up the Arctic Council in the mid-90s when the Canadians came and proposed its establishment. So I just sort of happened to be in the right place at the right time when Arctic policy became a thing. And so I've been watching Arctic policy develop, in particular, from the advent of the Arctic Council on through the current day. I retired from the department 4 years ago. I've been at the Wilson Center and have a number of affiliations outside of government.
You covered 30 years pretty quickly there. There was a lot in there. You just happened to, you know, toss out the fact that you happened to be there at the right time for the creation of the Arctic Council and really kind of maybe the advent of, you know, Arctic policy that might be more common in our vernacular now, although that's, of course, evolved almost so that Arctic policy isn't just Arctic policy. It's beyond that in a way that maybe it wasn't at the beginning. And what I mean by that is to kind of pull us back to your connections to the Pacific, not just, you know, professionally before the State Department, but even at the State Department, you started to interact with some Pacific nations in the context of Arctic policy. And as you know, we've talked a little bit about the Arctic-Pacific Security Dialogue, an initiative we're starting up here at the Stevens Center. I thought it'd be helpful for maybe you to give us some context on not so much how it came to be that Pacific nations were interested in the Arctic, but maybe so more so why.
Well, Pacific nations have been interested in the Arctic for a long time. Many of the key Pacific nations are very active in law of the sea, shipping, and maritime issues. And so the connection to the Arctic Ocean is something that's been important to them. A number of countries have been active in science, have science stations in the Arctic, have been operating or even building icebreakers in order to go to both poles. So there's a long history of connections. I should mention that in terms of the diplomacy, The State Department and other U.S. agencies have been talking to Asian nations about polar issues for a long time. We had 10 years of annual meetings of Law of the Sea and Polar Dialogue with China between the Chinese MFA and the State Department, where I was the head of delegation for that. And we talked about any number of issues, including what the countries were up to, their icebreaker support, and other related issues. So, other countries that have been particularly active include Japan and South Korea, which have extremely strong science programs and a long history of interest in the Arctic. And another that some often don't know about is Singapore, which is also, among all these countries, also an observer in the Arctic Council. And they have, in particular, strong shipping interests that drive their interests. So there are economic ties, interest in energy, and also interest in what other countries are up to. So part of that is Russia makes up half the Arctic, and so there's a real interest in the geopolitics of the Arctic. But also China is more and more active, and therefore countries like Japan and South Korea are interested in understanding what countries like China are doing in that region. And so all of that leads to a kind of vibrant level of interest among those countries.
So here you kind of paint a picture as I kind of jot it out. I mean, every nation is going to have its economic interests, its energy needs, and of course the geopolitical relationships that they're going to have to foster and care for. And what you're outlining to me here is that whether it be Japan, South Korea, Singapore, India perhaps could be added to the mix, China, as you mentioned, has these interests in this region. And maybe you could kind of calibrate differently for each one. But to support all of that, there needs to be some scientific backing, or at least some data that goes into how can it be economically viable. Maybe it's from fisheries, or maybe it's from a mining, or maybe it's oil and gas. And then, now it's mentioned oil and gas, you're talking energy. And of course, once you get into a space that's not within your control, you have to deal with geopolitics. And if geopolitics are involved, you get to diplomacy. And so you can kind of see how the lines are connected here. And to go back to what you said about the creation of the Arctic Council, when that was first created, it involved the members of the Arctic Council. And of course, there were the observers to the Arctic Council. So then you start to more easily answer the question why these countries that you just mentioned, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, and some others, why they would either want to be or are observers to the Arctic Council. Would you say that the interests of, I guess, pick your country, but you listed some off, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, are the interests of those countries aligned with the United States when it comes to the Arctic, or is there more to it than that?
I'd hesitate to say that the interests of the U.S. and China are fully aligned when it comes to the Arctic, especially recently as China has become more and more active in cooperating with the Russian Federation, including on military matters. The Chinese are not don't have a very large military presence in the Arctic, but they're doing a certain amount of air and sea coordination with and exercises with Russia that the U.S. and others are looking at and trying to understand what the motivations are. I'd say that in terms of security alignment, the Japan and South Korea and the US are pretty strongly aligned in terms of their alliance. And then in terms of the Quad, which the US is in with India and Australia, you have India that showing a greater interest in coordination and cooperation with the US. It also has a watching brief related to China. And the India, and as you mentioned, India is present in the Arctic for science, shipping, and other economic purposes. So, alignment of interests is not equivalent across the board, but certainly US, Japan, and South Korea have a lot of similar ways of looking at things.
Is this a would you consider this a new geopolitical theater? New in that it's a convergence of countries and interests that hasn't existed at least recently. When I say theater, I mean say the Bering Sea, North Pacific. Sort of region where some of the countries we've mentioned here are now converging. Interests are might be different, but the areas are the same. Is this new? And if it's new, what are we to make of that? Maybe it's not new, or maybe
I
you'd
guess
argue
it,
it's not really a relevant theater.
yeah. Sorry, I had to interrupt. I think it depends on what you think of as new. So, back 30 years ago, there was less focus on climate change. But that with the receding ice caused by climate change, everything has become more accessible in the Arctic. And that is having huge impacts on the region and the people who live in that region, and also the ability of countries to get there and do things there. So it is kind of this general opening up. And in the 90s, there was this sense of opening up, but it all took some time, particularly in terms of diplomatic attention. So, going back to the establishment of the Arctic Council, back in those days, I like to say that if someone showed up at the front door of the State Department in Washington and said, "Could you send me to the people doing Arctic policy?" They wouldn't know where to send you. Yes, they could send you to someone who was working on Finland or Sweden or something like that, or Canada. But in terms of Arctic policy as being a different sort of thing to focus on, that was coming into being. And it took a number of years for that to really take off as the eight Arctic states began to cooperate through the mechanism of the Arctic Council and create what became the most important diplomatic forum for the Arctic. Now that has changed a bit since the full invasion of Ukraine by Russia, which caused the work of the Arctic Council to be paused initially and then to be resumed at least partially after that. But it still hasn't come back fully because the political connections with Russia have been damaged significantly. So you have the Arctic Council not being able to operate as it did before.
So I want to come back to a couple of things you mentioned there, but as long as we're talking about the Arctic Council, And as you've brought us sort of to where the Arctic Council is at today, we might as well stay on that, because people might be wondering, what is the future of the Arctic Council? Of course, to be clear, the Arctic Council doesn't cover security and defense issues, but you could make the argument that the Arctic Council is able to do that because it didn't have to for a while, I guess. Or another way to say that is that the security and defense weren't necessarily the issues that needed to be covered in the Arctic. And so, in a sense, are we at a point where, because we're talking more about security and defense in the Arctic, that basically quiets the voice of the Arctic Council or the work? I know it's not paused. I'm just trying to understand where it fits now, when the main topics are security and defense, or at least seems that way, but this mechanism, that being the Arctic Council, is not permitted to cover that.
So let's start with what the Arctic Council is.
Okay,
it
great.
Is a high-level forum among the eight Arctic states, and it has it is supposed to have a ministerial-level meeting the foreign ministers coming all together once every 2 years. You have two-year-long chairships, originally called chairmanships, but now called chairships. Now it's Norway, and will transition to Denmark in short order. In the Ottawa Declaration that established the Arctic Council in 1996, the eight Arctic states agreed that military security issues would not be covered, and there were various reasons for that, but they didn't want the council to be a security forum as such, and that type of discussion would have been awkward with the Russians, more than awkward in many respects. Instead, the council focuses on sustainable development and environmental protection. And its most important work occurs through a series of working groups, technical working groups, and sometimes other expert bodies that it creates, that allows experts from the eight Arctic states and from a number of observer states to come together and do great work on shipping or environmental protection or emergency preparedness and a bunch of different issues where cooperation has been possible. So once the other thing I'd mention is that the council worked relatively well in terms of being a bridge to Russia and being able to have relatively constructive dialogue among all of the Arctic states. But once the Russians did their full-on invasion of Ukraine in 2022, it really wasn't possible for the Western states to continue to have that kind of outreach to Russia or cooperation with Russia, and so things kind of broke down. And in that context, certainly the council doesn't work as a security forum, because it's not the place for that type of issue to be worked with the Russians in any event.
Yet even so, I mean, I'm glad you clarified a lot of that, because it's important to understand what the Arctic Council is and is not, in order to understand how it's been effective and how it could be. And of course, you don't need me telling that to you, but it's important for other people to understand that. That's not to say, though, that the Arctic Council hasn't served as, you mentioned there's the ministerial meeting, and just recently is a few years ago when the chairship changed from, what was it, Iceland to, I believe it was Iceland to Russia. At that ministerial meeting, the United States had an opportunity, led by then Secretary of State Blinken, to meet with Foreign Minister Lavrov to discuss security and defense on the sidelines. So if nothing else, it gave an opportunity for foreign ministers or the Secretary of State of Arctic countries to convene at a particular location in the context of the Arctic, but also to talk maybe bilaterally or multilaterally on the sidelines of such events, thus proving at least some value to those high-level conversations that could still be valuable in the future. Evan, I want to ask you about the Central Arctic Ocean Fisheries Agreement.
Before you go there, okay, can I just make one
yeah,
point
please.
About the Arctic Council as a security forum? So yes, military security issues are formally not covered by the Council, but I've always thought in governance terms of the Council as being relevant to security, or a kind of security forum, in part for the reason that you just mentioned, because high-level officials through the Council might have discussions with counterparts, but also because of the way it created channels, particularly between the US and Russia, at relatively senior levels, including between national security agencies. So they may not have been talking about military issues per se, but they were talking about areas of cooperation that created a context in which it was easier for these countries to get along. And so from that point of view, I think it added to security, included, and also economic security as well for the various countries.
So are you saying that creating these channels, as you put it, would I guess, give an opportunity for, say, if there was a message to be conveyed between the United States and Russia, that it would be known that there's a channel that's been created in the context of black carbon in the Arctic, and that might be a form in which we could communicate something back and forth. I'm just using one example. Maybe it's on search and rescue might be a better example, where we're working together on that. And that's a mechanism. At least there's a channel to communicate, and some communication is better than no communication, even if you're not deliberately talking, you know, defense minister to defense minister or what have you. Is that kind of what you're saying there?
So I think so. I mean, the relations and foreign relations between countries has a broad set of issues that go under that heading. And the more that countries, particularly ones that are strategic competitors, can find ways of being in the same room and having their officials get to know each other and have the foreign ministries get to know each other, contributes to their ability to work with each other when, you know, difficult situations come up. And so, I think we experienced that with the Arctic Council, and there was a lot of value in the coordination and cooperation that occurred in that context.
I just before we dove into that a little bit, we were talking. I wanted to bring up the Central Arctic Oceans Fisheries Agreement with you, and again, this might be something that probably should be celebrated more if it was better well known. I bring it up because I'm trying to identify what I think might be helpful for people, and that's in today's geopolitical context. Sometimes we're looking to identify things that are changing so we can measure if things are improving, not improving, getting better or worse, you know, more favorable to one entity or another. You're a polar governance expert, and I will call you an expert because you certainly covered this and have for some time. And the Central Arctic Oceans Fisheries Agreement has been celebrated as a success of polar governance. and the need to know more information about a particular place before countries can go extract, in this case, fisheries resources from a particular area. Is the Central Arctic Ocean's Fisheries Agreement threatened right now? Is it something that can withstand the pressure to for more resources out of the Arctic? And if not, maybe this example, what other governance issues might we be looking for in the Arctic, whether it's related to shipping? You mentioned UNCLOS earlier. What might we be on the lookout for?
So first, with respect to the Central Arctic Ocean Fisheries Agreement, it encompasses 10 parties. It was signed in 2018, and it's the first international agreement of its type among both Arctic and non-Arctic states. And it takes a precautionary approach to the question of when and how fish stocks may be exploited in the future. There's no current commercial fisheries in the Central Arctic right now, but as the planet warms and as the Arctic warms, it's predicted that fish will move north. And so you have to have not only the Arctic states involved in discussions, but countries with that operate distant fishing fleets, like China and Korea, and in some respects the European Union, to be able to have discussions about the possibility of future fishing in the in places like this. So this agreement was negotiated. It takes a precautionary approach. It sets up a joint program for scientific research and creates the basis for, if there is a need in the future for a regional fisheries management organization, then through this process that can then be negotiated. But the other part of it is it creates a moratorium that will last at least until 2037, 16 years from its entry into force, and would continue in five-year blocks after that, as long as no party objects. So you ask the question, is this threatened? I don't think it is. It's operating relatively well at the moment. Unlike the Arctic Council, which is partially broken down, the Central Arctic Ocean Fisheries Agreement, which includes Russia, has continued to meet. And its scientific bodies have continued to do their work. So it's an example of, even though there are serious global geopolitical tensions, but in the context of fisheries, it's been possible for countries, including Arctic states and non-Arctic states, to continue to work together. So hopefully that can continue.
So along those lines, then, in regard to polar governance, then, are there other things to be on the lookout for that might be changing? Or let's just bring up law of the sea in debates there. I mean, I'm not necessarily asking you to look at a crystal ball and say, is the United States Senate going to take up ratification? That's certainly something that maybe, you might argue for, but don't have much, certainly much control over whether it'll happen or not. But maybe perhaps more you could talk about, enforcing things like polar code. Is that something that Will withstand, say, when I talk about pressures, it's increased shipping and increased demand for resources. There are governance structures, some more strong than others, some more binding than others, that for a long time have stood up to, at least for the most part, the challenges that were presented to them. Trying to identify more of those, Polar Code and things along the lines of shipping, but even abiding by law of the sea, other such things that you might identify as, hey, let's keep an eye on whether countries maintain their commitment to them, and let's keep an eye on whether they are enforced, if indeed they are enforceable. Things along those lines.
So I'm glad you mentioned the Polar Code. The Polar Code is a series of regulations that were developed under the auspices of the International Maritime Organization. The IMO has continued its work despite the pressures caused by the invasion of Ukraine. In that context, as in the UN generally, things have become more tense and a bit more difficult. But in terms of shipping regulations and work on navigation issues and shipbuilding and these sort of things, there has been an ability to continue to meet and do the work that the organization is required to do. So that has some, positive aspects to it. Another area of polar governance that's worth thinking about is extended continental shelf. So in the Arctic, the littoral states around the Central Arctic Ocean, U.S., Denmark, because of Greenland, Canada, Russia, Norway, all have areas that go beyond their exclusive economic zones, where they have certain entitlements to subsea territory. And that subsea territory has to be delimited. You have to figure out where the lines are. And that is in the process of being determined, in a process that takes many years, under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And it's being done relatively cooperatively. The US just finished its work in declaring what it believes are its areas of extended continental shelf. And the other countries have been doing that as well. And the U.S. has rights to continental shelf, whether or not it's a party to the Law of the Sea Convention. So it's something that was felt as strong national interest to make sure that U.S. Claims were understood and publicized and all of that. So all of these countries are, doing work in this area, and over time and through negotiation will figure out where their entitlements are in the Central Arctic Ocean. And that, that process continues.
A lot of good connections there and a lot of good things to keep an eye out for. Speaking of connections, you just released a book chapter on the ways that geopolitical tensions impact the Antarctic treaty systems. Of course, we're a podcast on Arctic connections, and here I bring up the Antarctic in the context of how geopolitical tensions can impact the Antarctic treaty system. But maybe you can tease out some parallels with the Arctic in the chapter that you wrote. And I kind of read this as Ukraine or increased PRC-Russia collaboration. Maybe there's parallels on the chapter that you wrote, for I guess the Antarctic to the Arctic here.
Well, the basic governance of the two polar regions are There are some important differences, but there are some parallels as well. And, one of those parallels is that the US and Russia are key players in both regions. Also, China is relevant to both. And China has a rising presence in Antarctica, even though it doesn't match what the US has there. Also, UNCLOS and marine issues are key in both places. Of course, Antarctica is a continent, while a central feature of the Arctic is its ocean in the center. In the Arctic, most areas are within domestic jurisdictions, and in the Antarctic, although there are seven states that maintain claims, no one owns it. And governance is via a series of treaties. So, in terms of the particular bodies that operate to provide that governance, the Arctic Council in the north and the Antarctic Treaty bodies in the south both take decisions on the basis of consensus, which makes it sometimes difficult to make progress on particularly controversial issues, but also ensures that the key countries are moving together lockstep. So when you have agreement, everyone has signed on. So there are these various parallels. But particularly in terms of sort of great power geopolitics, where many of the key large countries are involved in both polar regions.
Certainly some interesting parallels there. To kind of wrap up here, as you know, I mean, having 30 years of diplomatic experience within the State Department, you've gone through multiple administration changes. Sometimes the situation or the problem set that you're faced with doesn't change, but the manner in which they're addressed does. What advice would you give new Arctic leadership, either at the State Department or those you've interact with, related to Arctic security, or global security through the Arctic lens? What might you bring to their radar as they populate some of the positions that will cover these issues?
Well, I think we are seeing a lot of changes in the Arctic region that are driving the interests of not only the Arctic states but the non-Arctic states. And so it's definitely a region that deserves a lot of attention. And as the environment changes, so do the circumstances of how the people who live in those regions deal with their daily lives and deal with continuing economic issues. There's just a lo awful lot to think about. So it's worth paying attention to the Arctic, and also ensuring that allies are working together successfully. Due to Russia's behavior, it drove Finland and Sweden into NATO. And as a result, all of the Arctic states except Russia are members of NATO. So that's a dynamic that is very important when it comes to dealing with security issues, and one that needs to be focused on in that context.
So you had mentioned earlier that had somebody showed up at the State Department a number of years ago and said, "Send me to your Arctic representation or your Arctic experts," and the answer then would have been, well, we don't necessarily have what you're looking for. Your answer now might be to retain, or your recommendation might be to retain some of the Arctic-focused offices that have been created across the interagency, because we need to be paying attention to this region in ways that we hadn't in the past. Would you say that's accurate? Because there has been some, I guess, just fundamental personnel changes throughout different organizations, not to mention strategies, of course, but actual offices that have been created that didn't exist 5, 10, 15 years ago. Is that fair to say?
I would be surprised if the new administration thought that there wasn't a need for a particular focus on Arctic policy as its own focus area. In part, that's because of the way the U.S. government has been organizing itself, but it's also has to do with the way that other countries with which we cooperate, including within NATO in particular, conduct themselves as well. And so they have Arctic experts and are looking to understand the Arctic world in a particularly focused way. So my guess is, when looking at that they'd want that kind of expertise to continue to be applied.
And the other part of that then being that, as you mentioned, allies working together to cover whether it's the region or the issue, Arctic region or Arctic affairs, that is to say, the importance of that is kind of not even worth. I mean, it more implied in that we need to continue to incorporate not only those perspectives, but sometimes the initiative or the leadership of other of our allied Arctic nations who have maybe an expertise in a particular area or have been the leader on a particular issue. Is that maybe another accurate statement? You know, take Norway recently with its conduct leading the Arctic Council on how it was well suited to do so at a challenging time, maybe as one example.
Well, I think it's partly that, but I think it's also partly that there is greater activity in the Arctic that needs to be managed. And I'm not talking just about economic activity, but in terms of access through icebreakers and being able to support the people who live in the Arctic, including indigenous and local communities, there's just an awful lot going on. So in order to build up infrastructure and potentially gain access to critical minerals that exist in various places in the region, there just has to be more attention and more development of infrastructure and activity.
And the Ice Pact could be perhaps an example of such a thing, working together with the Canadians and the Finns towards a collective goal of increasing icebreaking capabilities, something that would be enduring between, really has been an initiative, you could say, through a number of different administrations. The need to develop more icebreaking capabilities has transcended leadership changes, and maybe one example there. Evan, we're looking forward to chatting with you more in the future, notably when it comes to our initiative on the Arctic Pacific Security Dialogue. There's so much to get into on that topic. I feel like we've just scratched the surface here today, but you've really set the table nicely for what might come next, and we're looking forward to welcoming to the program at some time in the future perhaps some of the colleagues that you worked with from Japan, perhaps from South Korea, to talk a little more deeply on some of these connections. But until then, we just want to say thank you for being here today, for your contributions, and we're looking forward to developing this line of effort going forward. So, Evan Bloom, thank you.
Matt, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.